Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them. Because they change things. They push the human race forward. And while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do.
To another episode of the Slongcast, episode 43 for Thursday, October 13th, 2011. As usual, I'm your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Howdy doody.
Howdy doody. Do you remember the show, was it Howdy, Howdy doody?
Yes.
I was going to say, do you remember the show Howdy Do, but that wasn't right.
It was Howdy doody.
It was Howdy doody. That was a good show. I miss all the shows that I used to grow up with. But do you have Nickelodeon by any chance?
I do. I don't watch it much.
After a certain time every night, like the new Nick at Night now is like all the stuff we grew up with.
Oh, like you can't do that in television?
Like, I don't know about that, because I really would love watching that. Yeah. But like all the cartoons from the 90s like and the late 80s. Yeah. All that stuff runs.
Ed, Ed, and Eddie. Actually, that was Cartoon Network.
Yeah, that was. And that was kind of later.
Yeah, it was.
Like late 90s.
It was.
But yeah, so for all of you.
What I remember is the USA... how about the USA Kids Club?
Oh, the USA Kids Club.
That and the there was the USA Cartoon Express.
I remember that. I don't remember what cartoons were on that, but I remember
it was like pretty much everything. I mean, I think it was a lot of the Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Oh, right, like Yogi Bear and
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey Boo Boo. Okay, no more voices because I'm not good. So, if you haven't noticed from the intro music, that was the Apple commercial. Because something happened in the past 3 weeks. Steve Jobs died, so that's our first topic. And everybody on the internet, even people that I didn't think knew who Steve Jobs was, posted something about it. So that was kind of interesting. What were your... I know you sent me a couple articles every now and then about Steve Jobs. So what are your thoughts about what he leaves behind and what his impact was to technology?
I think, you know, I have like a lot of opinions about Apple. and I, you know, I never would wish any ill upon anyone who founded, worked, or works for Apple. Or, you know, there's a lot of values there that are very respectable. I got no qualms there, but I will say that I think that the amount of credit given to Steve Jobs for technological advancement, you know, and I just saw some quotes that were just maybe a little bit over the top, like, you know, he created the world we live in. I think was one of the news media outlets had that as their headline, maybe CNN. I can't remember. That said, I mean, he's an amazing businessman, and he was able to, you know, see a market and grab it. And in addition to that, his vision on what a, you know, how a technology could be wrapped into something accessible to someone who's not like technology minded.
Right.
I think that was a pretty big contribution of his.
Yeah, and that seemed to be the thing that a lot of the media outlets, whether they glossed over on purpose or just didn't know, but if you don't know who Steve Jobs was and what he did, you would have thought that he made the iPod or mm-hmm. he made the iMac.
Yeah.
But like you said, it wasn't him that literally made stuff.
Right.
He was the vision guy.
Yeah. That's part of it, but I think you know, I think that this, the amount of credit that they give to him in terms of the modern PC era, or the modern, I don't even want to say PC era,
it's the modern digital age.
The modern digital age, yes, exactly. Like smartphones, you know, I saw a quote and I kind of agree with it. They said that, you know, had Apple, had the iPhone and the iPod and MacBooks never existed, where would we be? And I don't think we would be anywhere much less than we are now. We would have, you know, probably a lesser appreciation for the design of a device. That's one thing. But in terms of like technology, like there's nothing that the iPhone does that a Windows phone in 2004, 2005 didn't do. Yeah. It just does it differently.
And that was one of the things that I was watching Twit. I can't remember if it was this week or last week, but somebody brought that up. They're like, you know, computers existed before the Mac.
Yeah.
You know, they just did it differently. MP3 players existed, you know, before the iPod came out. Phones existed. Smartphones existed before the iPhone came out. So it wasn't like they were inventing new things.
Right.
They were just doing them differently.
Right. And some would argue better, you know, that they did them better.
Yeah.
But there's trade-offs. In every Apple product that's out there, while it does excel at it, you know, in industrial design and that sort of thing, there are huge trade-offs that they're making to get to that point in you know, freedom of use of the device and the formats it supports, the type of software you can run on it. In the case of like a MacBook or a Mac desktop,
right?
Not really so much the other ones, but anyway, there's trade-offs that are made. But anyway, you know, I don't want to take anything away from Steve Jobs' legacy, but I think the press was overstating his contribution to our digital world, and it sort of disrespects those people that did build this world,
right?
Like
Woz and Johnny Ive and those people who worked for Apple who actually did the hardware and the design work.
Yeah, those guys are examples. But even before that, I mean, here's an example of something that I think would make our world a lot different had it never been invented, and that's the internet itself. And Steve Jobs had nothing to do with the internet.
Did he? I heard something which was pretty funny, and they were saying that, what's his name, Tim Berners-Lee, when he was coming up with the idea, inventing the internet, he was doing it on a Next machine.
But
Steve Jobs' company invented Next.
Yeah, but Next didn't exist when the internet was invented.
Really?
Well, I mean...
Next was what was there, because the Mac didn't exist, or the iMac, you know what I mean? Between the times of the original Apple computers and when the Macs came out, like that's when Steve was fired and invented Next.
Yeah, I know, but the internet was invented, by DARPA in the 70s. Like, well, it started in like late 60s, early 70s.
I don't even know if that's true, what I just said.
Yeah.
I just heard somebody say it, and I thought it was interesting.
Now, granted, at some point, you know, the original ARPANET became the internet, and over time, it evolved, and there were new revisions and things. But
right.
But Apple's, I've never written or read any notes from Steve Jobs, like any of his like personal journals. But you know, maybe he did see the internet as a big part of the future. But he didn't. He wasn't part of the development of it.
Right.
So I guess my point is like the internet is probably the biggest influence on the way we interact with people today. It's by far, it's bigger than the desktop. You need the desktop PC to. And phones and stuff to access the internet, but they could be dumb terminals for all it really matters. You know, they could be,
and that's really what we're going toward now. Anyways.
Well, right, but yeah. It's like seriously, the architecture could still be that there's mainframes, and you still access things through like this remote device that just is a dumb terminal for this mainframe. But then the mainframe connects to the internet. So, no matter how you look at it, you know, you could still get on the internet depending on what type of framework you had. It's the internet itself, though, is what makes all this communication possible.
To counter that, I think the pro Jobs counter or idea to that would be, I couldn't think of the right word. If you only could have seen my face. I think the Pro Jobs point to that would be that, yes, the internet would have been around, but he brought it to people who wouldn't have used it otherwise. Like, if the internet stayed as that techie ARPANET style thing that you needed to have, you know, mainframes to use, yeah, you know.
I agree in some aspects there that it broadened the user base, you know. But on the other hand, the things that have the most mass market appeal from Apple are the iPhone and the iPod and the iPad, the, you know, the tablet right, or the iOS devices.
The small devices, yeah.
Right. And iOS, I think, is a segmenting force in terms of the internet. It's going to, you know, it's right up there with the way Google, Facebook, and all the other big players are sort of fighting over control of people on the internet. And I think that the reason I say that iOS is that segmenting force is that it's pushed us from web page development to app development. And while they're very similar, you know, in a lot of respects, it's the web. There's no, you know, the web is open and free, and you can do whatever you want. You just have to follow the HTTP standard, and you can do whatever you want on it. But, you know, iOS
is open, and you can do whatever you want. Yeah, you just got to follow the Apple standard.
Well, but see, anybody, any company, any person, any organization, any government could implement tools and things that used the HTTP standard.
Right. It's
where on Apple, you have to run Apple hardware. You have to use Apple development tools. Well, I guess that's not entirely true. You can.
Well, you might as well say that you have to.
You basically have to, yeah, or pay a lot of money otherwise. And, you know, so I think it's this like segmenting force. So
you're arguing against the vertical integration of Apple owning every part of their process.
Yeah. I mean, I know we've gotten off top. I mean, again, I don't mean any disrespect.
No, I mean, if you can't talk about it here, where can you talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, I still think that he made and had a big impact on design in technology, you know, and but there's other people that, you know, like Douglas Engelbart, you know, he's the guy that first demoed a GUI with Windows and a mouse and hyperlinks and all those other things.
Hyperlinks.
Yeah, I mean,
take those for granted now.
That's even before the internet existed. He had invented this hyperlink or hypertext, you know, idea. And this is in 1968. You know, he was working for Xerox and he demoed all this stuff and it was like amazing. Like they had pulled this together into this system that they had built then. So there's people that I think made huge contributions early on, that you know, I think deserve a lot more credit for the way things are.
So before we move on away from this story, what do you think? When do you think in the future Apple is going to not be Apple? You know, how many years out? I'm going 3 years out. A change might happen just because the product cycle for the next 2 years is probably already in place. But do you think that's going to happen?
Well, there's a lot of talk about how Steve was really good at pulling people together, you know, that had the traits he wanted, you know, and like sort of pre-picking his successors, right, and stuff like that. So it may be a lot longer than that if that's the case. I mean, I don't even know how realistic that is. But I've also seen some articles, and I don't know if I sent you this one, but I can't even remember where I saw it, but it basically talked about how Apple will probably vigorously defend the sort of like cult of personality that Steve Jobs created. And if they do that, if they make that their part of their business model, it may never die, you know, right, at least on the surface. I don't know.
It's going to be hard for them to not ask what would Steve do,
mm-hmm,
because, you know, if you just, people change, you know, the way they look at things change. I mean, look how Steve has changed from the original iMac with the big blue bubble to the way it is now, you know, silver polished metal. Mm-hmm. You know, if they just keep thinking of what would Steve do and it's just based on his legacy of right now,
mm-hmm,
you know, that's probably going to be a problem because Steve would adapt in the next couple of years. So they could take that to one extreme and totally screw over the company.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, the thing is, I don't know that they're doing anything differently from other companies that, that the other company couldn't also make a perfectly well integrated piece of, like, you know, I think BlackBerry's are really well integrated pieces of hardware, and I do think that they're one of their limitations, you know, probably is performance, but they run Java. All their apps are Java based, and you know that was a trade off they made early on. They wanted to use a system that was, you know, wasn't as close to the silicon, so that they could use a development environment, you know, platform right. that people knew. And
right, they got a lot of people because of
right.
that. Right,
early on they did. Yeah. You know, and now it's, I think obviously the ties have changed. But the thing that Apple did is they chose a different, you know, I don't know much about Objective-C and how it's compiled, but you know, maybe it runs a little closer to the silicon. They were able to, you know, it's their own system, so they were able
Objective-C
to tweak
it. Objective-C is C with some changes. It's right. still compiled the same way.
So it's compiled to bytecode then yeah. instead of and not interpreted by a virtual machine like that. So, you know, I guess there's just differences that they've chose, and it paid off in some instances, and you know.
Yeah, and that's what makes products what they are, you know. Mm-hmm. Every company does something different. You pick the one you like the way they do it.
Right. And I still think this last point in Steve Jobs' success, I still think If you measure success by, I don't know what you measure success by. There's a lot of ways
can
to measure it. Yeah,
you
maybe
know?
You can't. But you know that. I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, Apple is worth a lot of money now. But if you look at the long haul, there are companies, you know, and I think Microsoft is one of them that have been way more successful over the long haul. Now, maybe 10 years from now. We'll look back and
totally change everything,
and we'll laugh at Microsoft and say, "Wow, look how awesome Apple is! They've had this success for 10 years."
Right. Or look at that free BSD company; they're making money now.
Yeah, or something. But anyway,
but before we end the Steve Jobs thing, I wanted to bring up a quote. See if anybody recognizes it: "A mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought, alone." Does that ring a bell?
Mm-mm.
Whenever I saw that, I thought, yeah, that's kind of what Steve did. That was the logo on the motto on the original Apple logo.
Oh.
Like the big scroll with a picture of a real
apple tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had Newton on it, right?
Yeah, like that was the original Apple slogan.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was really small text along the side of it. You would have never saw it unless you were looking. But so Steve passed away in the past week. Another person passed away that you brought to everybody's attention.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to the sort of the people that, you know, I mentioned before that had a lot more to do with the way the world we live in. And that's Dr. Dennis Ritchie, the founder or the creator of the C programming language and co-founder of the Unix operating system. Dennis Ritchie worked for Bell Labs for nearly all of his life. It's now known as Lucent Alcatel or something like that.
Yeah.
It's, you know, over the years.
Emerging of a couple companies.
Yeah, it was AT&T, then it was Bell Labs, and then, you know, became Lucent Technologies. And he retired a few years ago. But this is a guy, you know, that, like, when he developed the C programming language, we were in an era of way more actual, like, silicon diversity. You know, now processors are actually a lot more similar than they are different. You know, we've agreed on standard sizes for words, mostly, you know, integer sizes and characters or ASCII, and it, you know, in his day there were different versions of character encodings, like
right.
EBDIC and ASCII, but and then also different byte sizes or character sizes, like 8 bits, 9 bits. So, point is, with the C program language, they were able to write a portable, higher level language that ran on all these different kinds of hardware. They ported it to several. First, they ran it on the PDP-7, and then I think later they ported it to PDP-8, and it also ran on this like Intella, or I can't remember the other system. But they proved everyone wrong back then, and now C has become the dominant, one of the dominant programming languages. It's there's a lot of versions of it out there. C++ was an enhancement to it. They still actually update the C standard. They just released C11.
Right. I mean, operating systems are written in C, like Linux. If you want to do Linux, you contribute to the Linux base, you better know C.
Yeah.
And I can't say this, but I think Windows, like, what else would you use?
I think Windows is mostly written in C or C++.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I don't know all of it. I'm sure some of it is, you know, higher level languages.
I'm sure newer display stuff is, you know, whatever, .NET or whatever, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, exactly. Really, you know, applications for Windows are obviously often written in C# or VB.
Right.
But the actual operating system components probably are C. Some version C or C++ or Visual C++ or something from Microsoft. But yeah, Unix, Linux, I mean, and Mac OS pretty much, and iOS completely owe their entire world to Dennis Ritchie because...
Right. Well, it's BSD and...
Yeah, BSD was a branch of Unix and it all evolved from what the work they did at Bell Labs, you know, and some of the projects back then, so...
Yeah, and you brought up a good point. I can't remember whether it was on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, but you're like, this, you know, everybody uses it, whether you realize it or not.
Yeah, I'd venture to say, I said 90% of hardware. It may be higher.
I said everybody just because.
Yeah, I mean.
Anything with a chip.
I'm pretty sure that you could not go through a day of a normal life without interacting with some piece of electronics that has some C code running on it. And that probably that C code was built with a library actually written by Dennis Ritchie. I definitely think that's the case.
No, I mean, that's true. You know, even phones, TVs, VCRs, small things, you know, they have chips. Software has to run those chips. Mm-hmm. And C, really assembly is what would do it. But a lot of people wrote in C and cross-compiled to assembly. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably everything you touch that is electronic.
Right. So I definitely think, actually, you assemble to assembly. No, you don't cross-compile. It's assembler. But anyway,
whatever. there's a dash C or dash F switch on GCC that switches your C code to assembly code.
Yeah. But anyway, I mean, I just think his impact on our world. If you program in C, you owe your career to Dennis Ritchie, essentially.
Yeah, really. If you program in anything, it all started there.
And if it wasn't for him, we might be using the previous language, which was B. Seriously, that's what it was called.
Really?
Yeah, the version of whatever, they had a high-level language at Bell Labs, and it was called B, and C was the evolution to that. I don't know if it happened to A. I don't know.
Where's D? Seriously.
Yeah.
Somebody tried to make D, but...
If you're a programmer out there, you should look for the book by Ritchie and Kernighan, I think, is the other guy that helped write it. I can't think of his name right now. It's towards the K. Those two guys, they wrote the book. It's called The C Programming Language, and you can find it on Amazon. That's a number
the
one.
Book.
That's the book. That's the book that started it all.
Nice. So let's get back to Apple for a couple articles. The first one is that the iPhone not 5 came out or was announced last week. Everybody was all hyper, iPhone 5's coming out, iPhone 5's coming out. Well, no, it was kind of disappointing. iPhone 4S came out. And, of course, I bought it. So I'm going to drive to UPS tomorrow to pick it up because they require a freaking signature. But it's not that big of an improvement. But here are the improvements that made me want this over my iPhone 4. 64 gigabyte built-in storage, which is awesome because now I can actually store my music on there.
Uh-huh.
The camera, I don't care that it's 8 megapixels, big deal. You know, the screen's too small to care. But better sensor, backlit sensor, so it can work better in low light situations, and an additional lens on it so it can focus better than previous versions. So the camera was one of the big deals. And voice control with Siri. I don't know what this is going to be or how it's going to work, but from the demos they gave, it seemed pretty cool. Did you happen to watch any of those videos?
I did watch I think I watched like the Apple, the official Apple, like
the keynote.
Not the keynote. That's like their official like commercially demo thing for Siri.
Yeah.
And you know, it's pretty cool. I'm not sure that voice recognition is going to become as pervasive as it is, mainly because I think it's annoying to other people. Now,
I agree with you.
There's a few people that said, "Oh, well, the way it works is, you know, you can, or I don't know if there's a setting, but you can, like, basically, if you just put the phone up to your face, you know, like you're going to
turns on.
It just turns on, and you can talk into it.
That would be amazing.
Now, I don't, or it turns on, but it listens.
Yeah.
So, there's that aspect of it.
I really hope that happens because I hate having to, like, press a button and do whatever.
Right, or, you know, I don't know if they'll do, like, a long hold on the home button or something. I have no idea how they would do it. Like, I had an application for my BlackBerry called Vlingo probably a year ago or something like that. And the way it worked was you'd assign it to a hotkey, and then you'd press the key, and then it would make a bing sound, and then you would talk into it. And it would do texting just like Siri does. And now the one thing at least I didn't have it configured, and I only had it for a little bit. I just grew tired of it. I just didn't find it very useful after I got Bluetooth in my car. You know, the one thing that I think it could do is also read back messages and stuff like that. But you know, I started looking for some videos on Siri last night, and I actually found one. I think Siri was its own company at one time, and I think Apple bought them.
Yeah, they definitely were separate.
Yeah.
Sorry, I kind of zoned out for a second because saying that made me think of the spoof somebody did with the GLaDOS voice for Siri. Did you see that video?
Oh, no.
Go ahead and finish your thought, and then I'll play it.
Well, I was just going to say I think it was another company, and there was a demo on YouTube. It was dated like 2008 or 2009. It was pretty
good. Siri's been around.
Yeah, and it was like an application on the iPhone, and it did almost everything that the iPhone does now. Now, it was kind of slow, and I don't think there was some things that it didn't do. So apparently, I guess they bought the technology and integrated it into the iPhone. But that said, you know, the Android system has had like global voice search for like quite some time now, which no one really seemed to mention. Like, you've been able to do that for a while on the Android phones.
Well, iPhone has had voice control too, but not like this. It was, you know, you had to know commands to make voice control work. You had to be like, you know, text message to Ryan Lancey.
Right.
You know, with
so
Siri,
it wasn't
natural
language.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. You know, but the one thing they mentioned about the voice control system on, or the voice activation or whatever on the Android, is that there's an API for it, and developers can totally take advantage of it, just no one has yet.
Right.
So,
and that's something that Siri doesn't have at this point.
It's an API, yeah.
So here's the video. So hopefully everybody knows GLaDOS, the bad guy from the Portal video game.
Oh, yeah.
And this is if GLaDOS is the Siri on your phone.
Read me the message.
New message from K. Bad news. Combustible lemons failed. Can you meet us at 10?
Reply, definitely. I'll see you there. Play my running mix.
Oh, joy.
What's the traffic like around here?
The traffic will be slow and meaningless. Just like your sad little life.
Text my wife, I'm gonna be 30 minutes late.
She won't mind. She doesn't really love you anyway.
Is it going to be chilly in San Francisco this weekend?
Not too cold. Your few extra pounds should be suitable insulation to keep you warm.
What about Napa Valley?
I hear it's beautiful there. Unlike you.
How many cups are in 12 ounces?
So you get the idea.
Yeah.
I really, really want that voice. You can get that voice for, I believe it's TomTom. That can be your voice on a TomTom if you have it.
Nice.
But I really want it for Siri. It's going to be amazing. But Ryan, you actually posted an article to talk about the specifically the cell speed in the iPhone 4S.
Yeah. So Anintech had an article about the iPhone 4S, HSPA Plus, and when HSPA Plus is real 4G. And it's pretty... I don't think it was really well written because I typically understood this stuff. But, you know, from what I read... is that, you know, HSPA Plus has different, like, revisions, okay? And they're currently at, like, feature level, let's just say X. And then, like, in X Plus 1, you get some other feature, like was it MIMO? It's like, is it multiple in, multiple out? I think that stands for, or something.
But I have no idea.
Multiplexed in, multiplexed out.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what that means exactly, but I know what it does is it essentially has like separate streams of data, and it can like, you know, utilize the encoding. It's like separate channels almost.
Well, what that should mean is that like text and data together, you know, multiplexing. So like not that that's what it does, but That's the idea of multiplexing, is that you have two separate things in the same stream coming in at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's exactly what it means. It's in terms of, well, it's not, it's used for data though. This is like, so two data streams.
Oh.
You know, so that you can take advantage of like spreading it out over bandwidth or something like that.
So maybe it's full duplex then? You can download and upload at the same time?
I think they would just call that full duplex, but I'm not exactly sure. What I do know is there's different features at different levels of the HSPA Plus, and this enables higher and higher bandwidth. And then there's another feature like dual channel. So if you go dual channel MIMO, then it's like, you know, four times the bandwidth, which gets you up into like the, I think it's almost like 84 megabits a second. So it starts to really approach LTE speeds, you know, because these are like raw speeds. They're not like, I don't think they're actual throughput. But it'll, you know, you start to really get up there. But what I haven't found is, and this is what I'm not sure of. They mentioned that when it comes to HSPA, just because you release an HSPA chip, you don't have to enable all the features. So you can say, oh, I have an HSPA Plus chip, but you don't have to enable certain, you know, features like that MIMO or whatever.
Right.
And you still get to say it's an HSPA Plus chip. But from what I can tell, this iPhone 4, it's going to max out at 14.4, even though HSPA Plus can go a lot higher. And I haven't seen anything to refute that aspect of it.
I haven't seen anything either way. I haven't looked hard, but...
Right.
Yeah.
When I read this article, he has a link that explains HSPA Plus outside the context of the iPhone. The article is a little bit older. So I read that as well. And, you know, he was mainly talking about how AT&T's implementation of it's going to work. And, you know, just because HSPA Plus can give you speeds of up to whatever, say 84 megabits a second, doesn't mean that your carrier is going to implement that.
Right.
But I don't see I haven't seen anyone saying that, oh, it's the carrier limiting the iPhone. Or vice versa. Like, you know, it seems like,
right,
AT&T's picked a solution and the iPhone supports that solution and the limit is 14.4 megabit. And the other reason I post this is like that slide they threw up during the keynote when they released the iPhone.
Yeah, it was the keynote.
Okay,
yeah.
The keynote. They compared it to a bunch of other 4G phones on AT&T's network. They didn't compare it to LTE. They didn't compare it to WiMAX.
Right. Well, that's because it's not LTE or WiMAX, you know?
Yeah. But I'm just saying...
I know what you mean.
They're
like,
oh, it's not 4G, but it's just as fast as these other 4G phones. It's like, yeah, but those 4G phones aren't real 4G phones.
Right, they compared fake 4G to fake 4G.
Right, yeah. And they're like all the same. Like, that bar graph was like stupid.
Yeah.
I guarantee... Jobs would have never let that graph been shown. I don't think he had anything to do with it. Like at that point, like,
yeah,
because he would probably have been pretty sick. It was a couple of days before he passed away, right?
One day. Yeah.
So my guess is he probably wasn't very involved in that. But that slide was just stupid.
Yeah.
Well,
it convinced people who don't know any better that, oh, this is just as fast.
Yeah.
Know? Although I'm not going to get that anyways because I bought the Verizon version.
Yeah, and I was like, and that's the other thing, and I'm glad you said that because I was going to stick my foot, but like, why would you buy the Verizon version if you can get 14.4 on AT&T?
Because, one, for principle, because AT&T was going to screw me with a $250 upgrade fee.
Oh, okay.
And I could break the contract, pay less money, and get on Verizon.
Oh, okay.
Two, all of my family is on Verizon.
Okay.
So talking to them's cheaper. And three, here's my thinking of three. I went to Verizon for the move to LTE, assuming that in a year the next iPhone will be LTE. Now, AT&T has already come out and they've started deploying LTE Advanced,
yeah,
which is way faster than Verizon's LTE, but it's only in 5 cities right now. So I'm thinking that by next...
Is it LTE Advanced?
Well, it might not be advanced, but it's faster. It's a revision faster than what Verizon's using.
I read that too. I read about those markets, and from what I've seen, it's no different than Verizon's LTE. It's just that it's not burdened yet. So there's no...
Okay, so that might be it.
Yeah.
The speeds were much faster. But either way, AT&T's future plan is to deploy LTE Advanced within the next couple years.
Right.
And Verizon hasn't said anything yet about that I could see. But either way, I'm assuming, this is just a big assumption on my part, that in the next year, Verizon will start upgrading to the next version of LTE. So I'll already... It won't matter what carrier I'm on because both will be there.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm hoping for.
Well, I think, you know, if HSPA Plus, that's the other thing. They say it's like 14.4 is the speed. But, like, I wonder, you know, like, I just know from experience, like, with HSPA 3.6 and 7.2 and also with, like, even Verizon's, you know, EDVO is supposed to be 3 megabit. It's rarely 3 megabit.
Yeah.
It's still pretty good. It's, you know, it's a megabit or so, but it ain't 3 megabit. And so I don't think that 14.4 is comparable to the speed that people are getting on Verizon network now, like 18, 20 megabit down, like,
right,
like actual throughput. Because I think the raw number for that is probably up in the 40s.
Well, the last picture on that article from AnonTech compares theoretical speeds of HSPA Plus and LTE, and HSPA Plus is faster. LTE at 5 megahertz bandwidth is 37 meg. At 10 megahertz, it's 73 meg. And at 20 megahertz, it's 150 meg. Whereas HSPA Plus is 42, 84, and 168. So theoretically, HSPA Plus is faster than the LTE that Verizon is using right now.
Right. Well, right. If it's implemented in its full, like with all the...
Right,
but
right.
I don't think...
Theoretically.
Nobody's doing that. That's the thing. Like,
yeah.
Like, basically... From what I can tell, we know that Verizon is not, or AT&T and I guess T-Mobile too, are not implementing those advanced versions of HSPA with like
the higher revisions.
Yeah, with the dual channel and the MIMO. And I've seen nothing that says once they do, the iPhone can take advantage of it, because I don't think it can.
The thing, what I don't know is that every once in a while, an update on the iPhone will be a, quote, baseband update. I don't know what that is. That makes it sound like, to me, like they're enabling features on the chip. Or they're, you know, changing code and software to let these features that the chip can already do work. Like, that's what I think a baseband update is, but I really don't know what they do.
It might be, but...
So I'm just assuming that if AT&T, whatever network... does enable HSPA Plus, you know, version 3, whatever, that Apple could release a baseband update to iOS and take advantage of that. I don't know.
But the other interesting thing on this is the chart they give here, they list the parts, the actual, like, the Qualcomm parts that are in these. And I guess the older... They list the MDM 6600 as the part that's going to go in. Well, iFixit just took apart. They did a breakdown on the 4S, and it actually has the MDM 6610. And no one knows what the difference is between the 6600 and the 6610 is. So there's some theories that the Qualcomm chip that's in the new iPhone, you know, might have some other features.
Right.
My guess is that the reason the current Verizon iPhone 4, not the non-S, had the 6600 in it, from what I read. And the reason, I'll bet money that the 6610 just enables HSPDA on the frequencies that are available in the United States, because they're different than the
right.
ones overseas.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting to see. So let's move on a little bit to our, we have a couple social stories. So let us know if you like the little interludes here. Trying to mix it up a little bit. But our first article talking about social media is something cool and much needed that Facebook is doing now, and that is they are adding malicious link protection powered by the WebSense products. So I'm sure everybody has seen and probably fallen victim to those things that look like YouTube links in somebody's Facebook stream. You click on it because the video looks like it's a naked chick or something, and then you get spammed, your Facebook account gets, you know, hacked, and that gets posted to your page and all your friends click on it. So what this is supposed to do is not let those links in.
Mm-hmm.
I've already seen this happen once. To me, I tried to post a link to Gawker. It was a tech article on Gawker, but it used Gawker's shortened URL, gaw.kr.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe WebSense is blocking all of Korea because it wouldn't let me post it.
Huh.
I had to go reformat the URL in tiny URL to get it to be able to be posted.
Huh.
So it's not perfect, but do you think this is a good idea? Something that they need? Or
yeah, I'm not even sure why they even wait till you to click on it to warn you. Why they just don't remove it to begin with.
Well, no, that's what I mean. They didn't let me post it.
Oh.
Like I tried to post it through TweetDeck, and TweetDeck just gave me some random error. Like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
I went to Facebook and did it, and then that's when I figured out what was going on.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm all for making it, you know, Facebook less malicious.
Right, because it is very malicious right now. But what is the article that you posted? Facebook Fool?
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name.
Namer Faraz?
Yeah, Namer Faraz. He wrote an article that made it onto Y Combinator News, and I found it interesting. It basically was just about how early on he worked for Facebook, and he was working on an application that had some competition internally, and it basically was a super cutthroat experience for him. You know, he was told that, we're gonna use your system, and he'd put a lot of time and effort into it, and eventually he was just like basically told to leave. And you know, he knew about some of the things they were doing with your data, and essentially he's just saying don't trust Facebook with anything because of the type of culture that's there.
Right. So they are malicious, whether they have WebSense or not.
Yeah. It says his closing sentence is think really hard before trusting Facebook or its employees with anything. Don't be a Facebook fool. So
that is I really wish he would have expanded on this a little bit.
Yeah, me too. I wonder if he's like bound by some sort of like gag order or something.
That's, he can't be, unless, you know, if he doesn't work for them anymore, he should be able to say whatever he wants as long as it's true. You know, you can't sue somebody if they're not lying.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should email him and ask him to be on the show.
Yeah, I'd like some more detail on it. But it was just a really, really, really negative post. And it got voted up pretty high on, you know, on Y Combinator. So yeah.
And I think that's something that most people just need to think about in general. The sites that you're using and the data they're asking for, like, really? I mean, I was really impressed the other day. My mom had said something like she went, I don't know, to use some site for something, and it asked her for some more information than she thought she should have put in. And she's like, I didn't give it to them. They're not getting that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, holy crap. You know, they learned. They're not putting in information.
Cool.
I almost brought a tear to my eye. So our last section of the day is just some general news. News at 7. I tried to perfect my news voice, but that was really lame. I'm sorry for that. So this first article is, it's not completely technology related, but it's really freaking awesome. Have you ever wanted to record your dreams? I certainly would love to wake up in the morning and then watch a video that is on my computer of what I dreamt of last night. I think that would be amazing. DVR for my brain.
Well, just be careful what you wish for.
Well, I mean, there are some really cool things that I dream and I know them as soon as I wake up, but then later on in the day I try to remember and they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, you just want that way to remember things. But that might be around the corner. So for all of you, you need to go to neurogadget.com and look up the dream recording article. Did you take a look at the video on here?
Actually, I wasn't. I don't know if I submitted this or not, but I had seen this a couple, at least a couple weeks or maybe a week or so ago before we talked about doing the show, and I did watch the video, and it's really, really freaky,
dude. So, basically, what they did is they hooked up electrodes to some people's brains, and they had them watch videos. You know, had them watch television, and through the electricity coming from your brain, through the electrodes, through the wires to the computer, whatever software they wrote, they were able to reconstruct the images. Now, it's not perfect, but it's kind of a ghostly feature, a ghostly figure like you would see on some bad 60 Minutes episode.
Yeah, it almost looks like an impressionist painting is the way I could...
That's good, yeah.
Explain it, like a Van Gogh painting or
it's
something.
It's very Van Gogh.
I can't remember.
I don't know. But it is kind of... Yeah. Yeah. But either way... Like, the first picture they show is a picture of Steve Martin in the Pink Panther movie. And then beside it, they show what your brain got recorded on the computer. And it is clearly a human. You can't tell it's Steve Martin, but it's clearly a human.
And yeah. And the colors are, like, there's sort of, like, skin tones where his face is and darker colors for his clothing.
Yeah, so everything is there. And it's really freaky. You need to watch the video on this. I wish I could show it, but this is audio, so you can't see it.
Yeah.
But
it's really, really crazy. Now, the one thing that from what I read is they call it like a dream recording device, but what isn't clear to me is if maybe they've, you know, what they're recording, is it brain activity that's caused by watching a video, or is it actually brain activity from just like thinking about you watching the video,
right?
Because those,
which part of the brain was engaged,
right? Those are big you know, big differences, because you know, if there's a specific part of the brain that processes imagery, it's not inconceivable that the way the brain processes
inconceivable.
It inconceivable it's the way the brain processes it isn't similar to like electronic video processing, you know, like, because you know, there's different ways to display images, like raster displays and, you know, vector displays and all kinds of things. But it seems like it'd be feasible that your brain might process things similar to the way that we've developed video technology, because we indeed invented
right.
it. Now, if it's actually like after you watch it and you're just thinking about it, that's a bit different. You're recalling images. But that still doesn't mean that your brain stores or doesn't store video images it saw on video differently than images it saw somewhere else, or images it dreamt of.
Right, and that's a very good point, because there was another article I read, didn't submit it because it has nothing to do with this stuff, but a guy that has, what's the flipper syndrome? Dyslexia.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he has dyslexia. He can't remember certain things, but he figured out a way, because of some video game or something that he was playing, he figured out a way to store stuff in different parts of his brain so he can remember things.
Mm.
So, I mean, that brings up a good point, you know, as to what they're creating this from, which part of the brain, where is the data
right.
at?
Is it, you know, because is this while they watched it, or is this...
This is while.
Yeah, so that's a little bit different. They may have just, like, hooked into, like, the neural process, or the...
Optic
processing,
optic nerve or whatever.
Yeah, that part of it. You know, I mean, I know they probably know what part of the brain they're reading, but they don't. You know, it's interesting. It's totally cool. Don't get me wrong.
We're not saying they're wrong, but we are saying we want some more data.
Yeah, I want some more data because playing back your dreams would be really cool,
dude. I really wish I could do that.
Yeah.
So our next article, we had talked before about Windows 8 and how they're getting rid of the standard desktop for the Metro interface. And this article from PC Mag basically tries to explain why the start menu needed to die. Here is why, quoth Microsoft. Nobody used it.
Well, anymore.
WTF. I mean, I have two problems with this. One, I use it all the freaking time. And two, the stats that they got on this, how did they get these stats? Do they have some sort of recording process in Windows that sends clicks back to Microsoft?
I think corporations can opt into it, and you can also opt into it.
Really?
Like, it's the feedback. It's like, you know, do you want to make your Windows experience better?
So that's what that does.
Well, it might. I don't know if that's the one. I know Office has that. I don't know if... I don't remember seeing anything.
Yeah, I've seen it with Office. But still, like, That's why they changed interfaces, because they say nobody uses a start menu. Nobody uses control panel. Nobody uses this. I use those things all the time.
Well, do you use Windows 7, though?
Well, when I have to. I mean, right. I'm a Mac person, but at work, when I'm using...
So you have Windows 7 at work, not Windows XP.
We have both.
Right.
But at school, it's Windows 7 as well. And
so, I mean, but have you really, like, ventured into the features that Windows 7 provides with, like, pinning to the taskbar and pinning, you know...
I guess the things I do at school, I'm teaching it, so I'm going into the control panel and showing them how to do things, so maybe it's not normal use.
Right. Like, the average... I found in my... You know, I don't consider myself a normal user either, because I'm a software developer as well, but... I have found that, you know, pinning things to the start bar is probably the way I launch most of my programs. There's actually two ways I launch programs in Windows, and it is rarely by clicking in the start menu or on the desktop, on an icon desktop. It is one, obviously, pinning something to the start menu. And for anyone that hasn't used Windows 7 or is a Mac person, doesn't know this, basically when you pin something to the start menu, it puts the icon permanently on your, pin something to the taskbar. It puts that icon on the taskbar, and it's there all the time. And then when you launch the application, it just sort of like puts a halo around it to show that it's like open. And then every instance of that application is sort of launched right from that icon. So if you had like four instances of Word open and it was pinned there, you could hover over it and you would see four little windows pop up. You know,
so they combined the quick launch feature of XP with the grouping of taskbar buttons.
Yeah.
Into one big thing.
Yeah, that's right. They did have that quick launch bar, which was mixed. People, didn't know how to use it really, and it was kind of like you could hide it and stuff like that. Yeah. It wasn't built in. And I think that's an example. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. When you start doing it that way, that's how I launch most of my programs. The cool thing is, you can use the Windows key, plus the numbers, like 1 through 10 or 0, to actually launch the applications right from there and switch between them if they're already open.
That is interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Second way I open programs is I hit the start menu button, the Windows key, on my keyboard, and I type, which is, like, in my opinion, the best thing that Windows 7 and Windows Vista did.
I do like that integrating of start run into that.
It's essentially a command line.
Yeah.
It's essentially a command line. You can run any application that way. You can run command line from there. It searches your documents. It also searches commands. You know, so not only if you type the command, so if the command is like for instance, to bring up a console window, it's CMD. If you type CMD, it shows up. If you type console or command, it also shows up. You know, or if you type print, you know, you'll bring up the print settings, the add printer, and you can select with their, you know, with your.
So it's a combination start, run, and search.
Yeah, it's awesome, and that's how I launch all the every time I launch an application, it's getting launched either from a pinned application or from me hitting the Windows key and typing.
That's normally how I launch things.
Right. Yeah. So. From what I've read, Windows 8 replaces this by having the start, you know, screen that you can pin things to that are your favorite apps or things that are like, you know, live apps that have updates.
Right.
And then if you want to search or run a command, I haven't heard specifically if you can run a command, but I know it'll search. Just start typing. Like, so you don't even have to hit the Windows key anymore. You just start typing on the keyboard.
That's cool.
Right. So... Now, I would actually kind of prefer that you'd hit the Windows key because then you could have you could indicate whether you want to run something or you want to do something else, you know. Like maybe, for instance, like typing, maybe you should filter your screen. Like if I type R, all apps starting with R should like be filtered on the screen or something.
Right, that makes sense.
So there's some usability things I think they have to work on there. And they've actually responded to some feedback about that on the start screen. So, but one more point I want to make real quick. Back on the point about, well, I forget what it was. All right, we can move on.
You said something like after I brought up something.
Yeah.
So I brought up quick launch. I brought up combination of task grouping of taskbar icons.
Oh, quick launch. I know what it was. You mentioned about, so, you know, everyone's, or every, You mentioned about the quick launch and how I said no one uses it.
Right.
And one of the reasons no one uses it is because you can hide it. You can get it out of the interface. And everybody's kind of screaming that, oh, this is a new interface. You're not really preserving the old Windows in there. And the reason is because they've done their homework and they realize that if you put a feature in there and you can disable it, no one uses it. Especially when you want it to become the new paradigm.
This is the Apple methodology. Tell people what they don't know they want.
Well, some of it, yeah. I like to think that Windows sort of like weans you into it. Like you at least get one revision to switch over. You know, for instance, I mean that quick launch bar is essentially, like you said, very similar to the pinned apps.
Right.
But so what they did is they let you sort of evolved into it. Like at first they give you this quick launch bar and you can like pin things to it. And then they're like, all right, now we want this to be the new way you interface. So we're going to make it permanent. And they did that in Vista. Basically, I think in Vista it started there. You could pin things.
Yeah,
maybe not.
I think they did pinning.
But anyway, you know, they made it permanent and now it's like the way everyone does it. And no one uses the quick launch bar anymore because it's sort of integrated. So
right.
I think that's why in Windows 8 you won't see... Even though you probably will be able to hack it, you won't see the Windows 7 desktop as the native interface. And it won't, like, and the start menu will be gone. Like, even though you can click on the desktop app and there's a start button there, when you click it, it takes you back to the start screen.
Right.
Because they want you to interface with it that way. I've been really, really happy with the UI updates they made in Windows 7 and Vista. Like I said, I love the searching from the start menu. And running commands from the start menu, and I love the pinning on the taskbar. So I have given them a little bit of trust on Windows 8 that I think they'll do it right.
Yeah, I like the way they redid the start menu with everything. I despise the way they've changed the control panel. Hate that. Trying to teach that stuff and tell people to change a network adapter, and it's now 30 clicks when it used to be 3. Like, just kills me.
Well, you have to realize the average user never goes in there. And here's the other part about that. It is 30 clicks, but if you just type manage network adapters, it's going to come up in the search results.
Right.
So, I found that too. Like, I found that the control panel is a little befuddling to get to, and things aren't really where they used to be. And, yeah, you can stick it in classic view or whatever. At least
it's still not that good.
It's not that great. Yeah. So, I just search for it. It's like, I give up. Like, you know, like... You've shown me a better way to do it.
Right.
And
maybe that's what they're trying to do, yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to get rid of control panel in Windows 8 and you just have to search.
Yeah, and it's fine. It works. I can get to it every time. One thing I think they should do is not only should it be an index search, I think everything in Windows should have a specific command to get to it. So if I want to know the key combination to get to it, even if it's like KDZW and that gets me to the control panel, or that gets me to the managed network adapter panel.
Shortcut keys.
That there's a shortcut key to get to it, or a unique name, a unique file name.
So just like Linux, where everything is a command that you can...
Yeah, essentially.
That would make perfect sense. Our next article is something that we have wanted, we as in the world, for a long time, and that is a la carte cable. According to Digital Trends... And Reuters, hopefully, you know, Reuters tells the truth. Cable companies are going to start moving to a la carte channel offerings as a way for us to lessen our monthly bill. The example they gave, ESPN is like the most expensive channel ever to have
it's
in
like
your package.
$4 of your cable bill.
Yeah. So if you want to lower your cable bill, you can choose to drop ESPN. What they didn't mention is that whether or not you could choose to add channels. I hope you can do that because I would love to add Nickelodeon because I don't have it at the moment and I want to watch me some iCarly. So I'm hoping that when they do this, you'll be able to do it both ways and maybe even not even have a package. Just pick channels. You know, ESPN's $4. Nickelodeon's $1. You know, CNN is 2 cents because nobody cares.
I think what you're going to find happen, though, is people... may drop the channels that are expensive, and those ones that are more expensive are ESPN, Fox Sports, Root, Versus, all those sports channels. They're the most expensive. And if the subscriber base goes down on those, and there's less money going into the pockets of the cable companies, they're not going to be able to afford ESPN. So they're going to have to raise that price for ESPN to everybody else. And I think what you're going to see is things like ESPN almost become like a premium channel.
Yeah, could be. Or it could... Well, because that money is going to ESPN too. So they're losing money, not just the cable companies.
Right, but ESPN may say, we're not lowering our prices. Like, we know those people really want that channel.
But people... But they won't, though. You know, that's the other side of the coin, is that they'll drop it if it gets too high.
They might.
So ESPN...
It might force the demand down, but, you know, I think the reason ESPN is in the situation it's in is because they probably have to pay a crap ton of royalties to the sports organizations. You know, yeah. NFL, NBA, MLB, all of them.
Right.
So since they really, like, if you think about it, I mean, I don't want to, you have to be careful when you say things. Like, what does ESPN bring to the table? They're really just buying someone's content and putting it on. And yeah, there's commentary and graphics, and they do a lot of work. I'm not saying they don't do work. But if you look at other television stations, they're sort of like coming up with their own programming. So there's a creative process there. Just even deciding what kind of shows you're going to carry versus, oh, we just carry sports.
Right.
So
yeah, like, but the work that ESPN does is stupid. Like, I don't care the last time that Barry Bonds hit a home run in a stadium with real grass that had the dome half closed on a July night when it was raining. Like, that's the kind of stuff ESPN does. I don't care about that.
Well, I mean, they may do a little bit of, what do they call it, like curating of the content in some way, but by and large, I do think it's mainly just a replay of the sporting event. I mean, obviously, I don't know who actually would be responsible for the camera work. I'm guessing it's one of the network's cameramen that you know, because sometimes they just rebroadcast it on other channels. But
yeah, I mean, here's the thing, like, I cannot tell you the last time I watched ESPN. At home, ESPN has not been played on my TV since I have lived here.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a huge sports fan, so I don't play. I don't watch
much. I do
much.
Watch sports.
Yeah.
And I just don't watch it. You know, I'll wait till if it's on network, you know, NBC, whatever. Like, I just don't watch ESPN. I don't see the need for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if people start dropping the a la carte ESPN channel, ESPN starts losing money, ESPN goes under, forcing cable or NBC. What's the word? Not cable channels. Broadcast channels to pick up the sporting events, and then everybody can watch them.
Well, I mean, if they really find out, I mean, I do think that many of the cable subscribers are essentially subsidizing sports broadcasts because I don't think most people watch it.
Like, right.
I mean, I think a large majority of people who watch TV. Or I should say, not majority, a large percentage of people who have cable and watch it also watch sports, so they want that channel there. But I don't think it's a majority of people.
Yeah, I mean, how many ESPN channels are there, too? I have ESPN 8, the Ocho.
Yeah.
That's how many channels there are.
You know, and the other side of it, too, is like most people, an even lesser amount of people watch sports all the time.
Right.
You know, like there's a lot of people that they can't live without ESPN or all the sports channels just so they can make sure they catch their local team, but they're only ever going to watch their local team.
Right, once a week.
Right. So for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
So essentially everybody has to subsidize that person. I don't know.
Ridiculous. So still speaking about viewing content, remember how we talked about Netflix splitting their company into Netflix, the streaming service, and Quixtar, the DVD service? Well, now they have a Netflix Quixtar, which is a third. No, they didn't split into a third company. They realized that that was pretty stupid.
Yeah.
Nobody could figure out what to do with two services.
Well, their stock price went down like 15% or 25%.
It was a lot of percent. Yes. Stock price went down, and people just couldn't handle two separate accounts because they were separate accounts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't just keep one database and let people log into both. So two separate accounts, and yeah, they just realized we screwed up. So no more. Quixtar is gone. Did you think this was a good idea to begin with?
Well, I didn't, but I will say that I think Netflix is in huge trouble, huge amount of trouble. I really do. Like, you know, they're up against Apple and the iPad, essentially, for streaming. I think most people, I think that's where the market is for streaming media, yeah, is iPads.
And I think I brought up last time that I downloaded the TBS, the TNT, the PBS apps. They're amazing.
Yeah, and they don't even have to... They can manage payments all through, like, PayPal or whatever. You know, everyone's like, oh, you know, Warner Brothers doesn't want to manage a million accounts. You just hire some third party to do right, all the financial stuff.
There's the million-dollar idea. Be the third party that all the TV companies can
use.
Well,
it's going to be VeriSign, or not VeriSign, but PayPal or Visa or one of these companies. They're going to get in on it.
They might be the payments, but who's going to manage the accounts? You know.
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying there. But there's probably lots of companies that do that already for other organizations.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so I just don't understand how Netflix really makes any money in the future if the movie studios and TV stations decide, we're just going to release our own apps. And if you really think about it, it's like, oh, yeah, but they don't want to have to manage a different app for all the different platforms. There's going to be three or four platforms. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, more than likely you're going to catch like 70 to 80% of the user base with two platforms.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to probably be iOS and Google for the time being. We'll see what happens with Microsoft and Windows.
Well, you know, I'm going to go with two platforms, iOS and Java, because I'm guessing that sooner or later, Android, BlackBerry, Windows, all going to go Java. That's my personal prediction.
I still think that'll help unify them in a sense, like for development, but there's still going to be system level stuff that you have to do. And they're going to need to develop separate apps. They're not going to just download a jar and it's going to work.
So that's what I'm hoping that they can do, that the VMs on each phone platform can handle the differences. And because you're only streaming video and audio, you're not doing cool things. Yeah. You don't have to worry about the differences.
Well, you may be right. Who knows? But I don't know. Apple or Microsoft doesn't support Java natively yet.
Not now. I'm assuming that eventually.
So...
Who knows?
But, you know, anyway, I just think they're in trouble. You know, Netflix is... And Google has their own movie section in their app store now, too. Android store. I've actually downloaded a few movies through it. I streamed one, and then I couldn't figure out how to do it, so I had to Google it. but it's stupid. I just didn't click on the menu button to even look. You can, like... You click, if you want to like download it, you just say, you click the menu button, you say manage offline videos, and then you just like pin it, and like it downloads the video so you can watch it without being connected to the internet.
Right.
Which is a huge one up on Netflix because you can't do that on Netflix. And it's nice you can stream it when you're at home so you don't have to take up space on your tablet, which is something you can't do with Apple's products. So like I think actually the Google Android movie store is actually best of both worlds. It doesn't have a great selection of movies yet, but that's just a matter of time.
Right. Yeah, this is just so funny. You know, Netflix is in trouble now, and 2 years ago, they were going to change everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they waited too long, honestly. They probably should have struck while the iron was hot back then and, you know, sold themselves to the devil or something in terms of, like, making deals with the movie companies because...
Well, yeah, they were trying to crush the movie companies, you know, back then, which is kind of stupid.
I know. I don't like they're the ones that make the con. Now, on the other hand, you know, there's a really good movie out there that I watched called Press Play Pause or Press Pause Play, something like that. It's about how the cost of filmmaking has gone way down in recent years. There's, you know, new companies that make movie cameras that are digital, like the Red digital camera, and some others that have brought high quality movie making down from hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment down to several thousands to maybe tens of thousands of dollars of equipment. And then there's other people that are using really good digital SLR cameras with expensive lenses.
I was going to say, you can make a cinema quality video on a 5D with a good lens.
Yeah, and you know, you have to, no matter what, you're never going to get around to having to buy good lenses or rent them or something.
Right.
So, you know, there's that aspect. You can just use a 5D or a 7D or any camera that can shoot 1080p or whatever video it shoots. Now, there's some downsides to that in the post-process. You know, if you start with I think they write to like MPEG-4, which isn't optimal for video editing, but nonetheless, you can do it.
Right.
And then there's also the whole like independent filmmaking world. and they've sort of been going around the companies. And, you know, there's a lot of critics that say this is going to ruin the medium. This is also true of music. This movie talks about the music industry in the same way that you can make a record at home now with equipment that costs a couple thousand dollars. You can distribute it on iTunes or anywhere, really. And this may be where Netflix wins. But that's long term. They need a solution for the next 5 to 10 years. Yeah,
they need to not go under in the next 5 to 10 years to hit that long term.
I'd say even just five. Like, if they could make it 5 years, stay profitable, stay popular, they may be able to. And with all that time, that they need to do is cater that industry of independent filmmaking, because if they don't need the studios to give them content, and they just cut the deals, they could become their own movie studio.
Yep.
You know, in essence.
I don't see them being that smart. I actually see them going under in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Those of you who use Netflix, chime in. Let us know. Have you seen anything else that happened in the past couple weeks that you want to talk about? I tried to pick out all the big stories.
Yeah, not well, you know, one other person that actually passed away this week he's not the founder of Motorola. He's the son of the founder of Motorola. He was the guy that he took over for his father. I can't even think of his name, and I that's terrible that I didn't remember it. But he took over his father's company when Motorola was just making simple like radio products in the 40s, 30s or 40s, and he brought it into the modern age where he was the CEO that invested in cell phone technology, wireless radios, and all this other stuff that sort of also brought us into this the world of connected.
Bob Galvin.
Yeah. Passed away 89 years old.
Yesterday. So. Or at least yesterday, this one the article was.
So it's sad week for technology giants.
Yeah, seriously, what's going on?
I think this is, unfortunately going to be pervasive from now on. I mean, a lot of the guys that really started this back in the 70s are getting
this
up there.
This is their time.
Yeah, they're getting up there. So
sucks.
I mean, Gates is like in his 60s now, right?
Well, Jobs was 56, so Gates has got to be around there.
Yeah, I think he's a little bit older than Jobs. Yeah.
That's crazy.
So
that is it for this week's edition of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you?
You can find me at www.lancypedia.com or on Twitter at @RyanLancy.
If you want us to talk about something, you got a question for us, feel free to send us an email, slongcast@kevinslonka.com. And we're trying something new with the articles. We're using a Google shared bookmarks instead of Delicious. And I'm seeming to like that a little better. But at the moment, I don't see how to make it public that other people can submit without having full access to the list. So for now, if you guys want us to talk about something, just email it to us, slongcast@kevinslonka.com, and maybe I'll find out some way to open up the list so more than me and Ryan can write to it.
Yeah, I've been disappointed with Delicious over the last several months.
Well, they went through a really big change.
They did, but what gets me is the people that spun it off, they totally changed some of the like basics, and I heard they brought some of it back, like what they removed, but...
But they added stuff and it's weird.
Yeah. What if we started a Reddit? A subreddit.
Subreddit?
Yeah, you can't...
What do you mean?
Like on Reddit, you could start a subreddit. We could call it Slongcast, r/Slongcast.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant to like kill Delicious.
Oh, no, no.
I gotcha.
No, we could do it that way too, because that would be like sort of public, but we could also...
Right, we can manage it a little bit.
And... Yeah.
Oh, have to look into that.
I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah, either way. So that is it. That was a weird way to end the show. I forget what I was going to say, so we'll talk to you next time.